Welcome to this planning meeting, Tuesday 7th of October. Please note that the meeting will be recorded. Are there any apologies?
There's apologies, Chair, from Councillors Beattie, Constable, Muirhead and Roseanne Wallace.
The order of business?
As published, Chair.
Are there any declarations of interest? If you can declare them now or when the actual item's coming. Okay.
I will declare an interest on Mount Lodian.
Item 9. Okay. Move on to the minutes of the meeting of 26th of August. Are there any comments? Taken as read. That will take us on now to item 5, guidance on the role of councillors in pre-application procedures, report by the Head for Communities and Economy.
Thank you, Chairman. At its meeting in May 2014, the committee were advised of the guidance published by the Commissioner of Ethical Standards in Public Life in Scotland regarding the role of councillors in pre-application process. The guidance clarifies the position with regard to councillors stating a provisional view on major developments proposals at pre-application stage. The purpose of this report is to advise the committee of the recommended procedures for councillors in the pre-application process. To enable councillors to express an early view on major development, it is proposed to report to the planning committee details of formal pre-application consultations by prospective applicants. The reports will outline the proposal, identify the key development plan policies and material considerations, and state a provisional without prejudice planning view regarding the principle of development. The committee will then have the opportunity to express a provisional view and raise any comments regarding the proposal. Views and comments expressed by the committee will be entered into the minutes of the meeting and relayed to the applicant and the case officer for consideration. The report also reinforces the current best practice of having a planning officer present with a councillor when they wish to meet an applicant to discuss a major development, whilst recognising that this is not always possible. Comments expressed by elected members are made without prejudice. In determining a subsequent application, the councillor's code of conduct states that councillors are expected to approach the decision-making with an open mind, in the sense that they must have regard to all material considerations and be prepared to change their views if persuaded they should. It is recommended that the committee agrees to the more detailed guidance and extension to the committee procedures. It receives a regular report regarding any formal pre-application consultations by prospective applicants submitted after the 1st of October 2014, and that a formal statement on the guidance is distributed to all members and a copy placed on the Council's website.
Will you just accept the recommendations then? Sorry.
Yeah, thank you. The guidance is welcome and quite helpful to us in the aspect. However, it still leaves that big black hole for elected members, where you'll see in 3.6 we talk about the major planning applications. There's a statutory requirement to hold public engagements in them, and in that paragraph it then goes on to tell councillors you can't speak at them. You can't say whether you are vaguely in support or whether you've got concerns or whether you've got worries. If you do so, you'll be debarred. It actually is contrary to everything that this is supposed to do, and that's to see open, honest and accountable local government and decision making. When you're standing at what is required of the applicant, and that's a public meeting in your ward, you're asked or you're expected to go along quite rightly, and yet you can't present an opinion or say you have any concerns or you actually think something would be good. And I think the public just look at you if there's something actually wrong with you. And I still think we should continue to make a noise about this and say quite clearly, when these come along to your constituents, we should be able to say we have concerns about them, we should be able to point out what their concerns are, or indeed, if we support it, we should be able to say we do support this, and here's why we support it, and hear the argument back and forward, because you're missing some of the argument if you're not putting your points. But yet again, the guidance still indicating to us that we can't even speak on the matter. I think it's very, very I'm sad.
Just to clarify, the guidance is in pre-application procedures. Is it in the pre-application procedures only? Is it in major only? Or is it in all? When you go into paragraph 2.3 and you quote from our previous paragraph 7.8, you've got the word major. Development authority might be minded in principle. Does the word major apply to all of this? Or is it just particularly being extracted from another document? And is this the procedures for every single application?
Chairman, the advice relates to major developments, which are subject to the pre-application consultation process. You most probably can appreciate, in terms of all scales of developments, the planning authority gives a lot of pre-application advice, but this guidance only relates to bringing before elected members the major developments.
Can you define major?
There's a statutory definition of what constitutes a major development. I know that's been reported to the Planning Committee in the past, so I can email you the details of that. But in terms of scale, we're talking, for example, residential developments of 50 or more dwelling houses, sites of more than 2 hectares. So it depends on the scale of the development, but there's a series of definitions.
Yeah, I think that's the key thing here. There is a clear guidance on what formulates a major application, and that's why there's a pre-application process. I think this is a welcome report, and certainly having the clearer guidance and updated guidance is always useful, but I think the Standards Commission are in danger of once again tying themselves in knots. I mean, we've had them here when they finally at one point did come, and I've heard them at times talking about the fact that elected members are perfectly well to give an opinion if it's not lodged as an application, but the minute it's lodged as an application, you can't give an opinion, so overnight you're barred from saying anything. So I think the Standards Commission themselves need to have a real good look at what they're saying and what they're thinking about it, but I think that as far as our own guidance goes, I think we're doing as well as we can.
Thank you, Chair. Just to seek some clarification on this, because my understanding all along has been that, yes, we're not allowed to give a view, to state our opinion, to give the impression that we've made a decision ahead of the determination. But it's always been my understanding that you can express the fact that you have concerns and to state what those concerns are ahead of a determination. Can I get some clarification on that?
Yeah, Chairman, I think this guidance is trying to clarify that insofar as that I think elected members have got to be really careful in stating an exact view on a proposal insofar as, yes, I would definitely vote for that, I would definitely vote against it. That's what it's saying to don't go that far. But it is reasonable for you to say, yes, I have concerns about the transport issues on that scheme or the number of units, or local residents have raised these issues, can I bring those back to the committee? So you can identify issues, and if there are issues that give you concern yourselves, you can identify them. I think this is just trying to stop you going that extra step and making a firm commitment one way or the other to the decision, because that then happens when you get the application. In terms of coming to the committee with a proposal, again, there's nothing wrong with, at that stage, the council through its committee stating its initial view. For example, if you've got a site which is allocated for housing in the local plan, and then we come to the committee with a report explaining what the pre-application process is all about in terms of that proposal, then it's reasonable for the committee to say, well, provisionally, the council would be for that scheme because it's identified in the local plan. So it is trying to give applicants a bit of security, because there is obviously a big commitment in terms of time and a financial commitment for them to progress schemes to a next level in terms of working up designs and transport assessments. So it's trying to enable the council to give them some comfort, but without prejudice in the actual final judgment of the application.
Is the committee happy with that explanation?
Yeah, sorry, Peter, I know you're not responsible for this, but I'm sorry, but you muddy the waters here again. In 3.6, it clearly talks about major planning application statutory requirements for public consultations. And in the last sentence it says, it is reasonable for elected members to attend such a public event without a council planning officer present, but the member should not, in accordance with the Commissioner's guidance, should not offer views. It's not sort of saying that you shouldn't say you're in favour or no, it's actually saying you should not offer a view. Now, I'm sorry if you say, well, I think I've got a bit of problems, or I'm sorry, that's a view when you start to get to that. And actually, this is where I come from here, is you're absolutely still in such deep, dark waters. I don't think anybody knows what we can do. And what I do know is that anybody that disagrees with us will end up front of the Standards Commission.
Chair, I appreciate very much the members' concerns over this. And it is something which is been discussed, obviously not in just this planning authority, it's something which is of relevance to a number of planning authorities. The relevant part of the guidance from the Commissioner, which is identified in the report, where it talks about as part of any such request for a view, and only as part of the planning authority considering informing such a provisional view, you are entitled to express an opinion in advance of the statutory application for planning permission being submitted. And the interpretation is that if you have a procedural arrangement through the planning committee, which is what we're suggesting here, that's the forum under which members can give a provisional view on the application to assist applicants as much as anybody, but also local communities in terms of the provisional view. What I would suggest, Chair, is, if it's helpful, is that on the basis of the debate here today and the comments from members, that I go back to the Commissioner's office and seek further clarification and raise these further issues with the Commissioner, and by all means come back to members with that.
Good luck. Okay, well agreed then. Which takes us on to item 6, Planning Performance Framework Annual Report 2012-13-14 by Ian Johnson.
Thanks, Chair. All local planning authorities in Scotland are required to make an annual return to Scottish Government reporting on the performance of their respective planning service. And this is known as the Planning Performance Framework Annual Report, which goes to Scottish Ministers. It's been running for 2 or 3 years now. I think the one we've just submitted is the third report. The report for the year 2012-13, which was submitted last year, Scottish Minister's response to that is referred to in the report that's before you today. And there were a number of, there were three areas of concern which were picked out of a total of 15 measures. And what we've set out in the report here is just an explanation of what they are and how we've been dealing with them. And I would hope that the committee would feel we've dealt with them reasonably satisfactorily. But we've also learnt from the comment we've had back and used that to good advantage. Report here before you also refers to the latest Planning Performance Framework report, which has just been submitted by ourselves to Scottish Government on time before the 30th of September as required. And that is for the year 2013-14, and we expect the Minister's response to that and any comments back from Scottish Government by the end of this year. Just briefly, in overall terms, the document, which has been circulated to members and another copy placed in the members' library, it wasn't added to the agenda as it's quite bulky. In overall terms, it demonstrates improvement across a number of areas, but most notably improved performance in the speed of handling of planning applications and good progress on the preparation of the local development plan. And what I would say is certainly more recent comment I've seen is that although there's a range of measures which councils are expected to be performing well on in terms of their planning service, the key elements are still, not surprisingly, the up-to-date nature of your development plan and the speed with which you're able to deal properly and competently with planning applications. But otherwise, the recommendations are as set out in the report, essentially for noting, Chair.
Thank you, Ian.
certainly think it's to be welcomed, and notable progress in reducing decision-making timescales is certainly welcome. Has there been any further discussion in recent times about the potential to increase planning fees as a result of improved performance, and not just in our authority, but across all local authorities?
Certainly, Chair, the Minister for Local Government Planning has made it clear to authorities, and has done for some time, that if, as authorities have been asking for an increase in planning fees to enable them to most efficiently deal with planning applications, what he has been consistent is saying is that he needs to see evidence of continuing improvement on the part of authorities across a range of measures, and that's one of the reasons why the planning performance framework arrangements were set up. I've not heard anything more recently. There has been an increase in fees, and certainly in the last year there's been an increase in fees. I know that the Minister's statement is that he has not ruled out further increase in fees, but he wishes to very closely ally that to increased performance on the part of planning authorities.
I suppose just to say on the back of that, it's good to know that we are certainly keeping up our side of that deal, so hopefully the other councils across the country are doing likewise, and we can see that coming through.
Accept the recommendations then at 6.1. Takes on to item 7, major applications currently being assessed and other developments at pre-application consultation stage. Report by Peter.
Chairman, that's just the regular update on the major applications and those applications which are subject to the pre-application consultation process. As ever, the report's for noting, unless there's any questions, which I'll happily deal with.
Just note that. Which takes on to item 8, appeals and local review body decisions. Report by Peter again.
Again, Chairman, it's just a report for noting, unless there's any questions. It explains the decisions for the couple of reviews heard by local review body in September 2014.
Accepted. Item 9. Application for planning permission for the erection of 9 wind turbines up to 102 metres tip height and associated transformers.
Chairman, before we go any further, as I am not allowed to vote on this issue, I'm now removing myself from the table and joined public gallery. Thank you.
Okay, I'll continue. The erection of switchgear building, erection of an anemometer, whatever that is, formation of access tracks, associated works at land of Mount Lothian Moss, Pennycook.
Thank you, Chair. members will recall being advised at the most recent meeting of the committee back in August of the decision by the applicants for this wind farm application at Mount Lothian. The applicants have chosen to appeal to Scottish ministers on the grounds of the non-determination of the application by Mid Lothian Council. I explained to members the timing and the background to that at the last meeting. So the matter is now with a Scottish Government reporter for decision or for assessment of decision, and the Council will have the opportunity to present its view and submit information on the application to the reporter before he or she makes their decision on the proposal by the applicant's wind prospect. The report which is before you here is a cover report with 3 appendices, and the purpose of the report is to seek the committee's decision on a number of matters and its approval to submit information to the reporter. Just to take you through the 3 appendices, Appendix 1 is the report of the assessment of the application, which you would normally receive, and a recommendation that had the Council been able to determine the application, in other words, had it not been taken out of the Council's hands, then the Council would have refused it for a number of reasons, which are set out at the end of Appendix 1. So that's a standard report on a planning application, the only difference being that, of course, the Council's unable to actually make the decision. It's, in this case, recommending the reporter to refuse the application, in other words, to dismiss the appeal. And the reasons are set out at the end of there in paragraph 9. The second appendix, Appendix 2, is an up-to-date statement of policy on wind energy developments in Mid Lothian. And it's due for inclusion in the forthcoming local development plan. As members will know, towards the end of the year, we're aiming to bring before you the local development plan for approval, ultimately by council, the proposed plan, the advanced proposed plan stage, for it to go out for a six-week period of notification and an opportunity for people to object. The consideration is that there would be an advantage, and there'd be an advantage in the committee endorsing that policy or that aspect of the plan in relation to wind energy developments at this time, thus enabling it to be put before the reporter as the council's up-to-date planning policy position on the type of developments which of which this application is one, namely wind energy development. Appendix 3 is, in a sense, a sister document to Appendix 2. It is the draft supplementary guidance which the council is seeking, which we're seeking for your approval, again to send to the reporter. Both the policy at Appendix 2 and the draft supplementary guidance Appendix 3 are also in accordance with and in response to Scottish Government planning policy on renewable energy, which is issued in June of this year. So it provides an up-to-date statement of how this council is interpreting and taking forward the most recent Scottish planning policy. Crucially, the draft supplementary guidance also includes the most recent work which we've completed on a landscape wind energy capacity study for Midlothian. And the details of that are, because the document is so bulky, again, it's been put in the members' library, but the essence of it has been taken in terms of the maps, which you'll see in the papers, and the rather more easier-to-read map versions, the larger versions, which are on the wall over there. Again, it provides an up-to-date position across the board in terms of how this authority sees the opportunities or not in certain areas for wind farm development, and provides that up-to-date position so the reporter is fully informed. And of course, subject to approval of the council here, the reporter would also have in front of him or her the recommendation that, on the basis of all things considered, this is an application which is cannot be supported by the council and therefore should be refused. If the committee is of a view that the reporter should dismiss this appeal, then it is recommended that the sending of appendices 1 to 3, plus the cover report, to the reporter would be the most effective way in which the council could pursue its case here. And that what I've just described there is essentially set out in terms of the recommendations in the cover report, which is before you today. I'm happy to take questions, obviously, on any aspect of that, but that's the recommendation, Chair.
Yeah, Chair, I think it's deeply disappointing that the applicant had chosen to take the action that they have, essentially taking the decision in this application out of the hands of the committee and essentially denying the local residents who would have represented views to a pre-application hearing the chance to have their say. I mean, we have a good record in working to try and manage planning applications as best as possible, and certainly in this situation, every effort was made to try and accommodate a date that suited the applicant for the predetermination hearing. So when we do that and you try to make these arrangements, and then suddenly, having tried to be as helpful as possible, the application's taken out your hands because the applicant appeals against non-determination, it really is very disappointing. That said, when we look at the detail of the application itself, I would very much support the recommendations within this report. I think we can clearly see clear planning terms for refusal. I think the outline in the report by officers is absolutely clear. I would also agree that the attached documents in the appendices should follow. I think it's very helpful that the additional work and supplementary guidance can be agreed at this stage, if that's the committee's mind, that we can have that endorsed now and included in our local development plan later in the year. But that certainly supports the work that's been ongoing. And the land capacity study, it was a number of months ago, in fact, possibly even a year ago, when we started talking about the need to update that. And the fact that we have looked at that and identified where it would be appropriate for any wind energy developments and the the size and scale of these will certainly prove useful going forward. So I'd be happy to endorse the recommendations in this report, Chair, but again, very frustrated and disappointed at the course of action that's been taken.
Yeah, I would just like to ask a question then come in, Ian. I'm very surprised that this application has taken this step, Ian. It was my understanding that there was close working between yourselves, the applicants and the objectors on the timescale and how this would pan out. Is there a reason that they've taken this step?
Obviously, applicants can choose within the terms of the regulations to take whatever action they think is appropriate in terms of pursuing their proposal. The position is that with a major application, then there's a period of 4 months within which local authorities can determine the application. And of course, they can determine it later than that with the agreement of the applicants. Once the four-month period has expired, then the clock starts ticking. The applicants then have a period of 3 months in which they can appeal non-determination. And so it's a decision at that point as to how far the applicants wish to allow the matter to go forward. In this instance, without wishing to comment one way or the other, the facts of the case were that we sought to have a predetermination hearing and to have a decision made on the application pretty much within the 4 months, or maybe by just a few days missing that 4 months. And we had sought to try and work with the applicants to get suitable dates. In terms of then that not being the case, then as from the 28th of May, there was a period of 3 months within which the applicants could seek to could appeal non-determination. We had at a fairly early stage in that process agreed that there would be a predetermination hearing towards the end of September with a decision on the application at this meeting here today. The applicants obviously exercised their rights within the three-month period following the 28th of May to seek to appeal non-determination. They're entitled to do that. Obviously, members may feel that that's perhaps disappointing that there was an arrangement for a predetermination hearing and a decision, but that's the facts of the case.
Yeah, I'm just going to add my voice to honestly say, as an affront to local democracy, this is quite simply taking the decision-making away for local elected members at this stage, and this is the way they should go through. They've obviously thought that they've, one way or another, that it's better for them to go directly in there and to ignore, to not have the predetermination hearing, to not listen to what local folk have got to say, both for or against. And I think that's really disappointing when you have this kind of working along with the planners to try and to verify that. I'm quite happy that we move forward with the recommendations in here. In fact, I would just go slightly further. I'm quite happy to agree anything that's attached, but I would also say that the officers should be free if there are any other material information that officers think might be helpful to winning this case. I would be quite happy to say quite clearly that if that then comes up in between now and the hearing being held, then they should be able to be free to use that information to help them. With that, quite happy to second Owen, if he's okay with that added catalyst.
Ian.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to endorse the comment there made by both colleagues that it does seem to detract from the democratic process, I think, to go through what appears to be larger technicality for the sake of just waiting a few weeks, but there we are. Other comments I'd like to make, or again, in general, looking at the landscape capacity study, I've stressed in the past that I wanted to see this reviewed, and I'm very pleased that it has been. It was very much discredited, it was out of date and not in keeping with the Scottish Government's targets and guidelines on renewable energy, so I'm pleased that it has been reviewed. I feel it is still a little bit too tightly regulated. I would like to have seen it relaxed a bit more. I'd like to make a few comments, though, on the specific planning application, because some of the comments I wish to make hopefully will be taken on board by the applicants if they do at some point in the future, or if other applications come forward, then they can perhaps be taken into account. On the actual specific application itself, I felt that there were a very large number of examples of quite lax preparation. If we look within the body of the document, for example, 5.45 on page 54, the RSPB advising there's significant shortfall of survey data for pink-footed geese during the September period, whereas that is the movement of the peak movement period for those. Ospreys as well, 5.46, evidence of osprey attempting to breed at Gladhouse, and this obviously wasn't taken into account. 5.49 as well, the Trust is concerned that, this is the Scottish Wildlife Trust, is concerned that potential impacts to pink-footed geese may have been underestimated. 5.50, the autumn vantage point survey did not start until 1 month after the start of the autumn period. Excuse me. And then for only 18 hours and not the recommended 36 hours. 5.51, the surveys at Westwater Reservoir were primarily daytime-based rather than dusk and dawn. 5.53, it's sizable gaps between the barriers and traps are referred to. 5.54, with regards to bats, the data is now around 2 years old. 6.11, which is on page 64, references again that, and this then, this refers to the actual wind speeds, which is another quite strong concern I have over this. I tried to investigate the data for wind speeds. It seems that monitoring device and anemometer, I think you were referring to before, is the device to measure the wind speed. This was not installed until February 2014, which was, I believe, after the original application, I think, was made. Now, these wind speeds, if you don't know what the wind speeds are, how do you know if it's economically viable? I'm totally astounded that this was not the first thing that was done, that wind speeds, absolute wind speeds, not those from a desktop study of statistical wind speeds across the region, which apparently was used, that's the basis on which the application has been put forward. We've got examples as well where I'm concerned on peat, I think 6.21, the impact upon peat has been underestimated. Another one, 8.56, page 81, another reference to no update from viewpoints from the previously withdrawn application, despite these comments being available prior to the resubmission of the application. There's tree felling in 5.66. Again, lack of wind speed referred to in 6.11. It goes on and on. I just feel that the application was put forward on the basis that they wanted something for this site. They wanted turbines for this site. They were not looking for the most suitable site in Midlothian to place turbines. They just wanted to put them on this site. And for these reasons, I would object to this application going forward. I really feel that a much more professional application were to be placed before us. And I'm somebody who, as you know, presumes in favour of turbine developments. We really need to invest in them for the future generations, but this is not one application which I would have any confidence in whatsoever.
No more comments? Okay, the recommendation is that planning permission be refused and that we send the three appendices to the reporter with our laying out a procedure for wind farms. Happy all that? Yeah? He's on to item 10. Application for planning permission considered for the first time. Report by Head of Communities and Economy. That's Peter, I mean.
Thank you, Chairman. This is an application for the erection of 349 dwellings on land to the east and west of Hunterfield Road and Gore Bridge. The application site forms part of Housing Site S, which was allocated in the 2008 local plan. a series of planning permissions have been granted for residential development across the site for a total of 541 units. A significant number of units have been constructed or are under construction. The application before you today seeks planning permission for material changes to the currently approved layout, the erection of different house types, and the erection of additional houses in four areas within the wider site. The relevant areas are shown on the location plan on page 138 of the agenda papers. The areas are identified as areas A, B, and C. This redesign and remix application will result in an increase of 41 units across the site, bringing the overall total up to 582 units. This application relates to 349 of those units. 233 units are unaffected by this application. The proposed changes do not impact on the provision of the new Gorebridge Primary School, the areas of open space, vehicular access arrangements, or SUDS provision. The houses are of contemporary design and will comprise a mix of concrete and slate roof tiles and render and brick walling. The site's allocation in the 2008 local plan means that there is a presumption in favour of residential development, which is not outweighed by any material considerations. The development itself is well laid out, providing distinct character areas and interesting spaces. The road layout remains comparable to the one approved under the original consent. Areas B and C are accessed off the A7, and area A is accessed via Greenhall Road. Off-site road improvements have been agreed as part of the earlier permissions. There have been four letters of representation and a petition containing 124 signatures. The recommendation is to grant planning permission subject to developer contributions and conditions.
No comments? Peter?
We have had a very unfortunate experience at New Bars, and I know we have been in consultation with the coal board, the coal authority, but I do feel we ought to have as much security that nothing untowards could happen and that we will be bitten in our backside when this all would happen, the same as it happened in New Bars. Have you evaluated that, please?
In terms of, we obviously consulted the Coal Authority as part of the planning application. They're happy with the current proposal. In terms of moving forward to the actual structural integrity of the buildings and how it manages potential gas or other sort of seepage from the ground, is always dealt with as by building standards. When after the plan application process, there's a building warrant process which looks at these details. So that sort of gets picked up at the next phase rather than at the planning phase. But in terms of the overall scheme, obviously the council in all its functions will ensure that the buildings are appropriate.
Chair, could I just add to that? In the light of the incident at New Byers, in terms of the building standards service, then we have added a standard comment in relation to building warrants that are issued, which does alert applicants to the potential, and I stress that, to the potential of gas seepage. So if applicants were not aware of it beforehand, which they should be, at least as far as the authority is concerned, it is a reminder just for them to be conscious of that and to ensure that they have assessed that particular risk.
So a question initially, it's in looking at the representations, most are dealt with in content of the report, but I can't see reference to the issue in the runoff water. But would that be dealt with through the any SUDs in the site or around the application area?
Yeah, I mean the SUD scheme is supposed to be sort of almost runoff neutral. Once the project is complete, you have a system which manages the runoff water. Sometimes issues arise which during construction you're putting in the SUD system, they're maybe not fully operational whilst the construction process is happening, so there may have been an issue which has triggered that objection. But as things move forward, the on-site provision should manage all the runoff water.
I think on that basis, I think having looked at the other issues raised and unbalance, I would move for recommendation in the report.
Just a wee question on the vehicular access. I can see it working no bother off the A7 for B and the C2, but I can see pressures to have vehicular access to the east side of C1 or linking into the other houses in that area. And also with Area A, you've only got the one vehicular access at the north side of the site as you're heading towards Newtland Toll. It just seems to be a big area just to have one access into it. Just wondering if there was any other consideration for vehicular accesses to the south side, linking it into the Clearburn kind of areas of Anderson.
No, Chairman. I mean, when the original applications were assessed and considered and all the early transport assessment work was done, it was felt that single access was sufficient to accommodate the residential development in that area, Area A. So we're not looking to add another vehicular access.
Brian, you happy with that?
It just seems that for the route, and I know the engine road route's not too far away, but you know, it's a bad route just now for traffic. And I was just thinking that area C1, you know, is so close to the main drag and the rest of Gore Bridge that maybe a vehicular access could have been considered there as well.
You just note that, maybe, Peter. Okay, we'll accept the recommendations. Right, we're doing the next two items under in private. So if we could ask the public to